Hello, welcome to episode number 215 of the Apologue Podcast. I'm your host, Simon Head. Before we get started, I'd like to wish my parents good luck while they're trying to get their RV fixed in the United States. They're stuck in a snowstorm, they're stuck in a hotel, and they're trying to get their ride fixed. So wishing you good thoughts, Mom and Dad. Hope you get back on the road soon and be in the place where you're supposed to be, which is warm down in sunny Florida. And good luck to y'all. This episode is brought to you in part by BetterHelp.com. Get affordable private online counseling anytime, anywhere. You can talk with a licensed professional therapist online now. You can get a 7-day trial with the code word Apologue when you go to BetterHelp.com/Apologue. And it's the time of the year, man. It is minus 1,000 out tonight, and it's very cold. I went for a walk, and I had to cut it short because it's minus 40 degrees out right now. So that weather can definitely affect one's mental health, okay? So go check in, get the 7-day trial and check it out. It's discreet, it's private, and it's good for you. Thanks everybody for shopping on Amazon. You too can support the show by going to apologue.ca/Amazon or apologue.ca/US Amazon. You can do it the old-fashioned way by going to apologue.ca and click on those banners located on the right side. You can locate your country, whether you're from the Canadians, the USAs, or the UKs. And you bookmark all those links, and every time you shop on Amazon, use those links to shop and support the show, and it costs you no extra money. I'd like to thank everybody for supporting the show on Patreon. You too can do the same thing by going to patreon.com/apologue. You can pledge as much or as little as you want on a monthly basis to help with hosting and gas fees, and you can cancel at any time. There's incentives there too on Patreon for the amount of money you give a month, and it really does help the show out. Believe me, it really does. The stuff ain't free. All the computers, all the things, all the talking costs money. You can go to apologue.ca/shop and buy a t-shirt. Go buy some music there too. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review on the show on iTunes. Give it 5 stars, please. Like the show on Facebook by going to facebook.com/apologuepod. And follow me on Twitter at simonhead666. Today on the show, I have Anna Navrota and Mike Miller from the band Voxomnia. They were originally in a band that I kind of got in touch with called Dearly Bereft, and really liked their band. Actually, our friend Cam Carpenter got us together, which I thought was kind of neat. Cam's been on the show before. Cam, it's getting to be your time to be coming back on the show, by the way. So you can buy some music by Voxomnia, the band. You can email them, voxomniatheband@gmail.com. Follow them at Twitter, at Voxomnia, and Instagram, at Voxomnia. And they're on Facebook, and I'll put the link in the description. Okay? So here they are, Mike and Anna from the band Voxomnia on the Apologue Podcast. Welcome to the show. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's did you have a good holiday? Good Christmas?
Yeah, really, really busy, but we tried to spread everything out nicely so we weren't too overwhelmed.
Yeah. And you guys had a busy couple of months with the new band?
Yeah. When did the album get released? We released the album in June, so we're just trying to, do whatever we could to promote it up until maybe the last month or so. And then we've started taking a little bit of time off to get into a bit more writing. So,
yeah. How's the process with you guys? Do you work independently together writing songs?
It started with me having a couple of song ideas in my head, and I just, my songwriting process is just, I'll have a couple of ideas and I need to get them out before I start moving on to other ideas or it just starts getting cluttered. Mm-hmm. And so I went to I went to a friend's place and we worked on a little bit, and then went and figured, might as well just record whatever we're going to be putting on the EP, and brought it to Anna. She listened to them and started writing, I guess, based on the music. But I think we're going to try to switch it up a little bit with the music that we're going to be writing. I think more of a collaborative effort rather than me just bringing it to her and, her going from there.
Yeah, it's a neat process that you say, because I'm in the same vein. Like, if I try to write too much, it has to go somewhere. You have to record it into your phone, you have to record it onto something. Otherwise, you have a lot of songs that start sounding the same. That's the big fault that I sort of run into.
Yeah, well, and it's brutal too, because nine times out of ten I'll think of a really like a nice melody or something like that, and I'll be like, oh, I need to get this down, but I'll be sitting at work, so I'll have to just like go to the bathroom and like hum something into my phone, and it's just like I've got a tin ear, so I can barely get it out onto the phone. But the roots are there, so.
Yeah, that it's an interesting concept of capturing something and then remembering what the essence of it was later, because that happens too. Like, you'll have this dee-da-doo-dops or whatever, and then it turns into a song somehow because you can remember what essence or what sort of drove the thing from the beginning, like the original part of it. You find that?
Yeah, I mean, I just once I sort of get it down, I spend maybe 2 or 3 weeks racking my brain to make sure it's not a song that I've heard from somebody else, because that's my worst fear, to write something and then put it out and people be like, oh, this sounds exactly like this other song. It would be horrible. So I take a lot of time before actually recording it.
Yeah, well, there's only so many notes, so it's kind of hard to Yeah, I used to record a lot of bands, and then when I record a band I liked, I'd end up writing a song that sounded like them. I don't know if that was like a just some sort of osmosis thing, or if it was a way of, I don't know, it was a weird process.
Yeah, I mean, it can definitely be difficult. I've sort of there will be instances where I'll hear something and a little bit will sound like one song and a little bit will sound like another song, but it's, I guess, hidden well enough that it won't really make that big of a difference, thankfully.
I just rewrote Graceland by Paul Simon.
Amazing.
It wasn't intentional until I listened to it. Oh my God, it sounds exactly like the start of Graceland. So I guess I went with it a little bit. But yeah, I've sort of taken a break from writing songs. I used to write a lot of songs about 10, 15 years ago. And then I slowly just, career kind of took over and I started working more and writing less. And I guess because, I mean, for music for you, it's something that you kind of have to do because it's part of you, who you are, right? Like, do you find priorities in life take a sidestep because of music?
I don't know. What do you think?
Like, would
Well, I personally recently went through focusing on like my career and building my career. Because I'm one of those weirdos who is a child of immigrants, and they're all very like education and lay the foundation for your life just in case the music thing doesn't pan out. So I was so focused on that, and I couldn't give myself fully to music. And I know that I have to be just fully focused on music to really give it my all. So I did that for now. And I think I'm just like taking a break and committing myself more fully to music, because there's a lot of things I want to do, like learn an instrument and work on my craft more. So that's kind of my journey with focusing versus not focusing on music.
Yeah, mine sort of it's back and forth, and I guess it sort of ties into the songwriting process that I have, which is just I'll get a bunch of ideas for something and everything else will take a back seat to that. And then it's almost like the well runs dry, and then there's a 6 month span where I just couldn't make a song to save my life, and then I'll start thinking of things and be like, oh, that sounds really good, and it'll go from absolutely nothing to five or six or seven songs all at the same time.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with taking a few years to write a record too. I mean, It used to be when it was, if it was your, I mean, a lot of people, I don't know if they do it as much anymore, but putting out records is a big thing, and trying to pump them out and not, you kind of lose focus of what quality is, because you still got to pump records out. Like, there's so many bands that I sort of followed in my childhood that just fell off after a while because they just couldn't do it anymore. Like, they got so comfortable with their music that they just couldn't create it anymore. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. It's, you know, it's a little bit, it's a little bit difficult, because I'm sort of the mentality where it's like, if I don't feel like this song knocks it out of the park, I'm not even gonna give it the time of day. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had conversations with friends who are doing music, and they'll be like, you know, just write whatever you can, put everything you can out there. And I'll ask them, I'm like, you know, what, like, how many songs do you think you've recorded that are, in your opinion, top of the line, some of the best work you've ever put out? And they'll be like, oh, 60% or something like that. Mm. I want it to be 100, you know, like, yeah. Maybe I'm a bit of a perfectionist in that sense, but if I think that the song sounds amazing subjectively, then I have no problem with putting it out. But if it's not up there, I can't do it.
Well, it goes back to the original idea. If you're humming into your phone or playing some chords and singing into your phone or into whatever you're capturing, and it doesn't strike a chord, it doesn't make it real, then there's no, like, I agree with you, there's no point to try to polish that, because you're essentially polishing turds, and nobody likes polishing turds. It's a horrible career. It's a horrible career.
I don't want any music that we put out to sound forced, you know?
Yeah. No, I agree. I used to do this where I would write a verse and a chorus, and then write another verse. And if I got to the chorus and bridge, like if I got to the bridge, then it was a keeper. If I'd never even sort of, I'd be writing, I'd have a general idea, play around with it. But if I could throw a bridge in there somehow, it was like, well, the bridge came out of nowhere. That makes it special. You know, that makes it special because you've just out of thin air brought something with all those summing the parts together to make a bridge. Because that's essentially a bridge in a way, right? It's like, kind of reflecting on where the song is, and, you know, the arch of the song, so to speak. But but you guys, you know, like, because we first met during the Dear the Bereft days, and is that still going, or is that just on the back burner? What's
I mean, I guess never say never on getting back and working. I mean, you know, with the Voxomnia record, like, we worked with a couple of the guys from Dearly Bereft. Ben came in and did some bass parts. Cyrus came in and did some keys as well. I think with this band, it was musically, I've always, you know, sort of had a couple of people that I was really conducive with. And I started to feel like I was using that as like a safety net. And I wanted to be able to sort of branch off and see what we could create without that safety, you know, because I had never written songs on my own before. I can't imagine you've ever written songs before as well.
No, these are the first songs I've written as a songwriter, and I just really wanted to also challenge myself and, you know, not sing other people's songs, you know, even though I was honored to do that, because most of the Dearly Bereft was Ben's songwriting. So I think that's a really big reason why we wanted to just kind of break out onto our own as a two-piece, really, to challenge ourselves and stretch ourselves and see what we could do.
No, I mean, that being said, again, we did have a lot of assistance as far as the recording and stuff like that, because we do, at the end of the day, like collaborating with friends of ours. I mean, we are in the great position to know a lot of really talented people. And so, you know, I would contact a couple of friends and say, well, this is a song that I'm working on. What do you think you can add to it? And so we would just go in when we were recording. I think maybe we had four or five different people that worked with us on the record. And it ended up turning out great. It was, I mean, like I said before, most of the people that I've worked with musically are very conducive with the sound that we were trying to create. And this is no different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let's hear a song. I have it over here. One sec. You have a personal favorite? I have all five. Is it really five songs, right? The CP?
Yes.
Five songs. Let's play Prom Song.
Cool. I know with five people in a band, it was a little bit difficult to get everybody and all of the instruments and stuff like that. But now it's like, it's the two of us. We run most of our stuff on backing tracks. So, you know, and it's good if we ever want to travel and play shows. It's just the guitar and a backpack, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. You can definitely, Well, we were talking between and I want to make this, you can definitely hear the 80s element to it, but you guys aren't, are you 80s babies? You guys aren't 80s babies, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm 84.
84.
I was barely an 80s baby. I was 89.
Yeah, yeah. 89. God damn it. You guys are so young.
I'm mid-30s, man. I'm recognizing that I'm not a young man anymore.
Right. Well, I mean, so, but did you, obviously you said you influenced, there's some influence of The Cure and Kate Bush and I hear that.
We sort of just, you know, it's not like we set out to make a really like gloomy record. It's just gloomy sounds good, you know? And I think like a lot of people are just trying so hard to be happy these days. And they, you know, they take that for granted sometimes, and they don't really appreciate that there can be beauty in sadness, you know?
That's true. That's definitely true. I never even thought of that when you said that. I was trying to think of an example, but you're right. All music is like, unless it's sort of hip hop that my son listens to, that seems kind of negative. Seems a little bit negative. Not gloomy though. Not gloomy at all.
I don't know that I've listened to any gloomy hip hop, but there's uplifting hip hop.
Yeah, suppose. Yeah. An idea out of that is like what you said is totally true. It doesn't just because it's gloomy doesn't mean it's bad or it's not supposed to be. You're not supposed to be going through emotions like that. And definitely there's a time and place to listen to every type of music. And this is definitely, for this EP, there's a few other elements too. I mean, like there's fake drums, there's real drums, there's like instruments. And how long did it take you to record?
I guess once we started recording, it would essentially be when we were free and when the people we were playing with was free and the producer. Probably took about 2-3 months over a couple of weekends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we're living a good time now to do stuff like that. There's a lot to be said, a lot of conversations about, well, computers ruin music and this, that, the other thing. That's because they've been treated the wrong way. They've been treated as tools rather than capture devices. And what you're capturing is emotions that are people can understand and with a computer because it's easier to do. Am I blabbing? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't really had any experience otherwise. I mean, like everything that I've ever written in previous bands has always been through the computer. So I guess I wouldn't be able to weigh in too much on that. But, there's still like, I was a little bit hesitant with, specifically, I know you touched on like some of it's real drums and some of it isn't. I was a little bit hesitant to go into the more like synthy sounds. Because I wanted to keep it as organic as possible, but sometimes if it just sounds good, it just sounds good.
Yeah. Well, just and it kind of goes back to you've captured something that it all fits together in a nice soup, So when you make a song and it all sort of fits together, you can tell the ones that don't make the cut are the ones that just didn't get put together properly. And there's nothing saying that you can't just try again to make it fit together. I mean, like Wilco, they did Yankee Foxtrot Hotel. They rewrote every song 3 times before they actually settled on what that record ended up being. And had they not done that, then that would have turned into, I don't know, maybe wouldn't have heard about Wilco anymore. So it's kind of neat to just really make sure that if it does click is to keep it. And that sort of hits back a little bit about recording on a computer because it's so simple to do and you can just get it. You know what I mean? You used to have to go to a studio. You'd have to put all your stuff in a car and set up in a recording studio and then record and then worry about the bottom dollar, like the bottom line about how much you're spending. It's really hard to create when all that stuff's on your back.
I think it's afforded a lot of opportunities as far as being able to get a good amount of stuff done in a small amount of time. And then you can sort of play around with it and see if you can add to that.
And it makes just music making more accessible for so many people. Like I've noticed that, a lot of individuals, like young women, probably wouldn't have the same opportunities if they didn't make their, bedroom recording EP with themselves and their guitar. And there's, enough talent and feeling in those bedroom EPs that they get record deals. And it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a little tough to try to filter through all of it, which is another problem with having computers, internet, is trying to find good avenues into good veins of music. But that still comes down to word of mouth because people still speak about something they've heard. The problem is that people can be a little bit more skeptical because there's too much of it out there to choose from.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, there is a certain amount of oversaturation these days. And, you know, I kind of miss the days of not even necessarily pre-internet, but in the, I guess, first years of the internet, where because I loved, you know, so many different genres of music, I could go out and be like, okay, well, if I like this band, let's check and see what their influences were. And, you know, that's where most of the music that I listened to came from, was just going out and researching. Mm-hmm. But now it's just like insanely difficult to do that same thing because there's so much music out there.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's still niches and there's still genres of niches that people can gravitate to. I mean, who says in 100 years from now that we'll have such refined tastes in specific genres of the same type of music where people will be able to determine more? We're like, we'll be old people going, get off my lawn. What are you talking about? There's two types of country, country and Western. But I mean, to be able to determine what different types of music based on sort of what vein it came from, that's sort of exciting because it makes you want to go out and listen to more to try to find the cool veins. It's like, obviously it's like digging for gold in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it doesn't necessarily need to sit in a specific genre. I mean, we were kind of talking about this while the song was playing, where we've had a lot of trouble figuring out exactly what genre we fall into because, you know, there's a certain theme to the music that we're making, but at the same time, it's sort of all over the place as far as what it sounds like. I mean, we have a couple of songs that sound really 80s. We've got a song that sounds very, you know, shoegaze oriented, and it's tough to market sometimes unless they listen to the whole record, you know?
Yeah. Well, it also comes down to you guys as people, because that's another thing that a lot of people forget, like as on their road to success, is that you got to remember the people that sort of, there's people who influenced you, and there's people that you meet at a bar, and they know you make music, and for people to root for you, you know. And that's all about, I mean, success in music isn't always about money. It's about recognition. It's about making an impact on what you're doing. But it also, at what cost? You know what I mean? There's a lot of people that sort of, they think once they've got there, they don't need to worry about the people that they left behind. And I mean, the genre part of it is sort of like what happens is if you changed your genre in your third record, that becomes your big million-selling record, that everybody that heard these other two EPs, one isn't released yet. I'm going on the fact that you're going to do another record. They're going to go, oh, well, I liked them before. You know what I mean? But if you're good people, they're going to root for you. And they're going to, I like that. I don't care what they do. I want to go along for the ride because I like them as people.
I hope there's something to be said for that.
Well, I feel like Mike and I had this conversation not too recently, but there were bands that started out completely, just sounding completely different in their first record. Like, was it The Cure?
Oh yeah, The Cure.
The sounded Cure. Really, the Cure sounded totally different than what everyone knows them for. And, you know, Radiohead's probably a good example. Mm-hmm. That doesn't scare me. I like the concept of artists growing and changing and you know, exploring things that they wouldn't normally explore. I like artists that do that. I crave hearing records that challenge me and make me feel weird. Mm-hmm. From artists that I love, because it just exposes me to something new.
Yeah, I have no problem with you know, an artist trying to pursue, I guess, different avenues and sort of expanding their horizons on the music that they make, as long as the songwriting is still there. That's why I'm not the biggest fan of, say, like Nine Inch Nails anymore, because I grew up with them, and then they just, I don't know, they went somewhere that just wasn't, it didn't seem genuine to me in their most recent stuff. But again, you know, he put out how many amazing albums? So,
well, there's something to be said about what you're keying into. If it, what makes popular music, what makes music successful, is that you key into a group of people who think the same way as you. And you can't fabricate that. Like, I've had a lot of conversations on the show about that. You can't fake that. Either you're in it and people gravitate to what you're doing because they like who you are, what you do, and why you're doing it, or they don't. You know what I mean? So writing the greatest song on earth is only a third of what's going to make a successful career in music, in my opinion. You know, you can write great songs.
That's why I can't really understand a lot of the new music, because it just it's lacking a certain amount of substance. You know what I mean?
I don't think that's true. I think, you know, top 40 is always going to be top 40, but there are some pop songs that I'm like, yeah, I feel the authenticity there. A lot of them I don't, but I don't know. I think maybe you're an old man now and you listen to what you listen to. And I'm still kind of like exploring a little bit and, you know, on Stereo Gum, trying to be like, who's new? What's this all for?
Give him 5 years.
Okay.
But understanding authenticity is in feeling like, because I said this before the Biebs had the baby single, but I said this all the time, is like, I don't care what you say is how you say it. You know, because you can say baby, I love you. And it's like the Beach Boys did it for many, many years. And I love the Beach Boys. But it's how you deliver it makes everything palatable to me. So if you really mean what you're saying, I don't care what you're saying, as long as you say something that I can relate to or whatever the feeling behind it.
Yeah, well, I mean, if the Beatles could do it with She Loves You, yeah, over and over again, then I guess anybody can do it.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Oh, I just found this thing again online. It was the recording notes from Day in the Life. And it's like this whole webpage, and it looks like it's probably 10 years old, the webpage, because it still has that old-timey webpage look to it. And they talk about, like, how they went to record it, and it took, like, 4 days just to, like, track it. 4 days on a four track, you know what I mean? Like, and then how they invented a way to put two tape recorders together, two four track machines together. They found a way to sync them together using just the ground hum, like from one to the other one. It's a fascinating read, because that song is the weirdest song on earth, but everybody knows that song. Like, everybody's heard it, you know, and they know what that song means. But I guess being the Beatles wouldn't hurt, right? Because if
that's why they're legends.
Yeah. Yeah, but you should look it up. It's really neat, because they go into depth about how many takes they took, and if you're into sort of old stuff like that, it's kind of a neat read, because it really does give you perspective about what had to happen. You know what I mean? Like, let's bring the orchestra in. We're going to do this part that they don't need to know what they're doing until we tell them. I don't know. It's cool stuff.
I do quite enjoy a lot of the factoids behind certain songs or certain music. Maybe it makes me insufferable at a party, but I just love being like, oh, you know, like I'll tell the one, the Otis Redding song, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, where it's like, he didn't have the rest of that song recorded. So he whistled it, and then he ended up dying, and they just put it out. Right. I love learning about the stories behind music. It's always been a passion of mine.
Yeah, I just got the Roger Daltrey book, and I haven't started reading it, but I still have to get through the Gord Downie book. I have, like, a lot of biographies. People give me biographies. The Michael Barclay biography on Gordon Downie, I've started reading it. He was on the show, actually. It was weird. By accident, I didn't realize he had written this Gord Downie book. I was trying to get him to talk about... a band that I can't remember what band it is, but he had written on them. Like, he's a journalist, but but do you find that, like, old music and new music, like, can it cohabit? Is there any ways of making it work?
I think there's, and I can only speak for myself on this one, but I think there's this weird generation gap thing, where it's like, you know, kids who grew up in the 50s or the 60s would listen to music from the 50s and listen to music from the 60s, and the kids from the 70s would listen to music from the 50s and 60s and 70s and so on and so forth, up until, I mean, even when I was growing up in the 90s, I would still listen to music from the 60s, whereas I found that these days people don't really listen to the older music more as much as they should. I know that it's, you know, an extreme generalization, but I don't know. It's a little bit strange. I hope that the newer music and older music can cohabitate. I don't know if it does, but I hope so.
Yeah.
No, I think it's a constantly evolving thing. I think people who love music and love music history and love the art of it are always gonna go back into the vaults and explore what were the building blocks of their kind of the artists that they love now. But I think it may be a bit of a different story for people who aren't as passionate about music. Like, I look at my sister who's 16 and she's not super into music, definitely not as much as I was at that age. And there's definitely differences between how I consumed music, like going back into, you know, to the 80s and 70s and 60s and listening to stuff from those eras at 16, whereas she's definitely into current music trends and like that's what she listens to and that's her thing. So I think it depends on the person and what they're into and how much they care about kind of breaking apart what music is and what made it.
Do you think it's the quest for new media that there is a whole generation that sort of, I like what you said, Mike, but because it's true, like old stuff kind of got left behind because the circle does repeat itself, but it just comes back in a weirder, less validated form. You know what I mean? Like soul is essentially top 40, you know what I mean? But no one can take that back to Casey and the Sunshine Band or even back to Otis Redding or Marvin Gaye and say, this is where this came from, because the difference between what's happening now with music and what's happened then, at least somewhere 20 years after, it kind of had some sort of relevance because of what popularity dictated. Like, you remember they had that Blue-Eyed Soul, like Huey Lewis in the News, man. That's soul music, man. That's what I thought soul music was. But if it wasn't for Huey Lewis, I wouldn't have gone back to Marvin Gaye. I wouldn't have gone back further. So there's always that gateway of band. So maybe we don't have that yet. Maybe we need to have more, like Elvis Presley needs to sort of make another resurgence so people can go back and listen to what was done back then.
I mean, I definitely think that it's not as prevalent these days, but it's still there. I mean, there's a gentleman that the both of us are really into named Leon Bridges. And he put out a record maybe 3 years ago, his first record, and it just sounded like, you know, 60s Motown, mm-hmm. like or even like 50s pop. It was fantastic. And so I don't know if people would hear that and be like, oh, well, let me try to figure out some bands or some groups from that time that he sounds like. I know since then, like the second record is more sort of soul and funk, but you know, there's still, and I found, I mean, even sort of, maybe not as much as music itself and people going back to older stuff, but movies are bringing people back. I mean, they had the Queen movie that came out. That's got a whole new generation of people into Queen. When, Straight Outta Compton came out, everybody, you know, I could hear people listening to NWA on the bus, and I was just like, I was listening to them like 25 years ago. But, you know, it does open the doors for a lot of younger people to be listening to this music that came out quite some time ago.
Yeah. I was just pulling up Nathaniel Rateliff, which is, he is like, you know what I mean? Like, has the same essence of Motown and whatnot, and then obviously sometimes he sounds like the band, but to be able to just to take a step back to say where that came from, it just didn't seem there wasn't as much danger as there is when it first came out.
Well, I mean, it's, I don't know, is there any danger in music these days? Like, I don't really think so.
I don't know, man. Those hip hop guys get knocked off for a lot. My son tells me about people that die. Like, there's this guy died, Willy Pop Peepop died sometime. Like, I don't know what he's talking about, but he is my son.
Who was a gloomy rapper, or personally, I think that the guy, Extension, I don't even know how to pronounce his name because he had three X's.
Oh, yeah.
And then, Anyways, yeah, he was like a gloomy SoundCloud rapper that was flexing a little too hard. And unfortunately,
flexing is the parlance of our time.
Yeah.
Well, they call it mumble rap, and that's the thing that drives me crazy, because they're actually calling it what its weakness is.
Yeah. Well, and as you know, somebody who is like a big fan of, you know, hip hop, it's tough. I know that there should be a place for everybody, and you know, they're young and they're doing their thing, and that's yeah. and that's fine. But man, I want some bars.
I'm so glad that people aren't like wanting to be YouTube sensations anymore, because there's that part's dead now. People are like, YouTube's unreachable now. So
yeah, I don't even know what's going on with YouTube these days. I mean, I'll spend way too much time on it, but it's, you know, few and far between. Now I just watch like people speedrunning video games. Like, that's what it's boiled down to at this point.
I used to use it for Tomb Raider walkthrough stuff, because someone would say, go to this link, and it would show how the person did the Tomb Raider. And this is still PlayStation 2 Tomb Raider, so it wasn't like, you know, the new Tomb Raider. But yeah, I don't game as much. My son is too... It's funny because my son's 15, and I used to love video gaming, and now he does, so I feel like I don't want to regress back to being a 15-year-old. There he is, right there. Hey, say hi, Everett.
Hi, how's it going?
He said I should play the... Did you hear that?
Yeah. Has he played the new God of War yet?
He played the new God of War yet?
No, I haven't.
No, he hasn't. Okay. So you're a 15-year-old, Mike, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, emotionally.
Emotionally. Well, go upstairs. You're not supposed to be on the show. Go away.
Yeah, no.
Okay. He said, play the new Tomb Raider. This isn't a video game podcast. Thank you. Well, well, hey, let's listen to one more song, and then we'll wrap this baby up. This is Real Drums.
It is, yeah. My friend Mario, he really had to like draw it back on. He played on maybe two or three songs, and he's to this day the best drummer I've ever met in my life.
Really?
Like, his favorite color is Neil Peart, so that shit is playing a lot. Like, using our folk band and. And it's funny that you put on this song they just used on a Canadian crime podcast. Like, I think
Canada Land, is that it?
No, the one that we've been on most is called the Nighttime Podcast.
Oh yeah.
But he's doing a split with another podcast. One just came out yesterday, and then another episode is coming out. I think podcast next week. It's Canadian True Crime.
Wow. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, you guys are like being like the soundtrack to that stuff.
Yeah, well, that's what we're sort of trying to get into at this point. Is, you know, I want to move more towards like thinking and licensing, because really we're too on the floor at this point.
Yeah.
So that's what.
If you want to go play Europe and tour around in a van and make no money, then that's doable.
Yeah.
Anybody can do that. Yeah. But that is what touring is. I mean, yeah, that's, you know, but actually you're saying licensing music out is, that was a big push, like publishing deals and things like that. I don't know what's happening with it now.
Well, I mean, we've been trying, but it hasn't gotten us too far. But you know, we've gotten the podcast opportunities, which is great. But we sort of get that through a mutual acquaintance, so we just got lucky on that one.
Right.
No, man.
Yeah, that one. That's why. You know, I keep telling Anna, like, any sort of chance you get to play a show or work with whoever, take it. You never know what the networking opportunity is.
Oh, so absolutely. Yeah, for sure. It's not, you know, it's, well, I mean, you're saying good stuff, and you shouldn't be saying this about the music site, but I won't be part of it. You should never, you should always explore what's out there, because it's, you know, people are willing to invest in your talent. You know, that's...
Yeah, well, I mean, we've also found out the hard way that it is a lot of people hoping to take advantage financially.
We've had
some opportunities where it's like, oh, your stuff is really good, we want to work with you, and then give us, you know, however much money and we'll do it.
Well, I think you guys would be smart. This is almost over. Yeah. I think you guys are smart enough to understand when people want to take you for a ride. You know,
we learn from mistakes.
Yeah.
Right now.
Well, I wish we had kept that because it's true. Because people want to sort of associate themselves with you based on a talent or where they think they can make money out of it. And to me, that's like, I mean, you know, for me, recording bands was always like, you give me money, I'll record your band, and that's it. We're done. You know, that's our relationship's done.
Yeah.
But for me to sort of go, I'm going to take your record and I'm going to manage you and I'm going to get you money and then I can get money. It's like, God damn, that life's too short. It's hard.
Well, I would be okay with that theoretically if the money was coming in first before they started getting a cut. You know what I mean?
This friend of mine's band, we're pretty prominent Canadian touring band, toured Europe and Canada, and they were on a small label, and the large labels came and knocking, and the first thing they said is, can you get us a $1.8 million guarantee? I don't know why that was the number, but it was an unreachable number. Can you get us a $1.8 million guarantee? And they were like, no. And they go, okay, well, we're not interested, because $1.8 million is going to put all of them out of having to work, you know what I mean, as a band. So I found that to be because when if someone said, oh, yeah, I can definitely get you $1.8 million, it still would even be another reason for them to go, well, we're not interested anyways, you know?
Well, you know, it's funny because I've gone to like a lot of different music panels with Indie Week and CMW and stuff like that. And I'll listen to these guys from indie labels or major labels. And they're all like, well, you know, you need to show us that you are capable of reaching this many people. And the whole thing is, if you're capable of reaching that many people, what's the point of getting a record deal? You're already doing it on your own.
Yeah, absolutely. My answer to you is, to them is, well, that's your job. Their job is to do that. And there used to be a time, I mean, I had our friend Cameron on the show, and he used to be part of a team. They used to sort of like take a risk and a chance and and it was always like a couple of records and then maybe you might sell some records. And that was how the industry used to work. And for someone to turn around and say, how many Twitter followers do you have? How many Instagram followers do you have? How many YouTube spins do you have? My answer is like, who cares? Do you like the music? Do you think it can sell? And if
you're,
it can,
you're doing this for us.
That's
the point of signing on with somebody. Well, and the one guy from a record label that was actually like had that mentality was Seymour Stein. And he was like, I disagree with all of these people. Like that was my job, to go out and break somebody if I believed in their music enough. And that's really what it should be.
Yeah. And that's sort of gone because it's turned into a jack of all trades career thing. So not only can you have to write songs, but you're going to have to figure out how to work a computer and get your social profile, your social networking profile up to speed. You're going to have to know how to talk to people and how to wheel and deal business. And I mean, that never existed in the 70s and 80s. Like, there's rarities. I mean, David Bowie controlled his whole career from start soup to nuts, but he's a rarity because he's super artistic and he's super smart with business. But there's so many people out there who can write great songs, but they can't hold a conversation. But who said they had to? You know, like, no one made that rule up. Who made that rule up where they have to be good at social networking? Who made that rule up? Not me.
You shouldn't have to be like an entrepreneur and an artist at the same time.
Because they don't mix music and business. I've said this for 20, 30 years. Is music and business what do they call that? Oxymoron? It's not supposed to make sense. Those two words don't work. You make if someone can make music from your or make art money from your art, then cool. But it should be done in a fair way where everybody is profiting from it. But if someone says, I'm going to take your music and I'm going to go make money and be nefarious with it and go take all your money and then go buy my house somewhere, it's happened. I mean, like, it's happened throughout the ages, I guess. It's not just recently or, you know what I mean? But I don't know. You can't fix the problem because, you know, the other thing I was thinking about is that there are slippery dudes in the major labels. We know that part, but there's equal amount of slippery indie label dudes out there. I can guarantee that. There's equally amount of slippery, mean, slippery dudes out there. Dudettes too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're sort of selling people on this dream that they have, you know, somebody puts out music and they want to push it as far as they can, and there will always be people to take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, if you just carry on and do what you love, and I truly think, though, if you take it from a, this could be something that we could sort of maybe end off in, is that if you take it as, I love to make music, and music is something that's part of me and something I love to do, why is that? There's no wrong there, you know what I mean? To me, I don't feel that there's anything, I don't care what kind of music it is, because if you're really into it to create something and make a wave, then I don't care what kind of music it is. Do you sort of, I guess you'd have to feel the same way, otherwise you wouldn't be making music.
I think
the main principle that drives us really is that no matter what happens, we're in it for the thrill of it, I guess.
Yeah, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine about, you know, making music and I guess trying to reach as many people as you can or you know, get a certain amount of recognition for it. And it's like, I can live without getting rich off of music. I can live without getting famous off of music. I can't live without making music. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't. Like, I'll always be making music. And whether it be for, you know, as many people as possible or 10 of my friends, it makes no difference to me.
Mm-hmm. Cool, man. Thanks for talking.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that was Anna and Mike from the band Voxomnia. Good couple of people. Good people. Good talk, good chat, nice people. Okay? So you can go check out that band Voxomnia. At Voxomnia is their Twitter. At Voxomnia is their Instagram. And just search Voxomnia, and it's a pretty unique name. You should be able to find whatever they're doing everywhere all the time. I think they have a band camp account and all that kind of good stuff. Everybody, thank you so much for shopping on Amazon, supporting the show. It's very, very helpful. Thank you so much. Appalock.ca/Amazon, Appalock.ca/US Amazon. Thank you, guys. It's very, 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 very helpful, actually. And, yeah. Thanks to the patrons. Thanks for going to, and you can go to patreon.com/Appalock and pledge the show. It's very cool. All right, so what I've got next week? Next week I got a friend. I haven't done the interview, so I can't say who it is yet. There's a tease. Once again, Mom and Dad, hope you get down to Florida safe and sound. Hope you get out of the snow and the cold and the dank and the Motel 6 in Medina, Ohio. Turns out I have been there. I've been there with bands. I think I did a show there with SNFU at one point. It's not the most chipper town, I'll tell you that much for sure. And so everybody, warm, happy thoughts for my folks in cold, snowy Ohio right now. So anyways, have a great week. We will see you again. All right? Bye.